sandwich board. It doesn't matter, and you know it doesn't. None of them bills a tenth of what Sharp bills. What else can I say? You know Sharp and the kid are going to want to talk to both of us. Do I book you a seat or not? The thought of 10 days, 5 in Boston and 5 in New York, gave Vic a mild case of the cold sweats. He and Roger had both worked for the Ellison Agency in New York for 6 years. Vic now had a home in Castle Rock. Roger and Althea Breakstone lived in neighboring Bridgeton, about 15 miles away. For Vic, it had been a case of never even wanting to look back. He felt he had never come fully alive, had never really known what he was for, until he and Donna moved to Maine. And now he had a morbid sense that New York had only been waiting these last 3 years to get him in its clutches again. The plane would skid off the runway coming in and be engulfed in a roaring fire cloud of high-test jet fuel. Or there would be a crash on the Triborough Bridge, their checker crushed into a bleeding yellow accordion. A mugger would use his gun instead of just waving it. A gas mine would explode and he would be decapitated by a manhole cover flying through the air like a deadly 90-pound frisbee. Something. If he went back, the city would kill him. "Raj," he said, putting down his meatball sandwich after one small bite, "have you ever thought that it might not be the end of the world if we did lose the Sharp account?" "The world will go on," Roger said, pouring a bush down the side of the Pilsner glass. "But will we? Me, I've got 17 years left on a 20-year mortgage, and twin girls who have their hearts set on Bridgeton Academy. You've got your own mortgage, your own kid, plus that old Jag Sportster that's going to half-buck you to death." "Yes, but the local economy..." "The local economy sucks," Roger exclaimed violently and set his Pilsner glass down with a bang. A party of four at the next table, three in UMP tennis shirts and one wearing a faded T-shirt with the legend "Darth Vader is gay" written across the front, began to applaud. Roger waved a hand at them impatiently and leaned toward Vic. "We're not going to make it happen doing campaigns for Your Choice Blueberries and the Maine Realtors, and you know it. If we lose the Sharp account, we're going to go under without a ripple. On the other hand, if we can keep even a piece of Sharp over the next 2 years, we'll be in line for some of the Department of Tourism budget. Maybe even a crack at the state lottery if they don't mismanage it into oblivion by then. Juicy pies, Vic. We can wave so long to Sharp and their crappy cereals, and there's happy endings all around. The big bad wolf has to go somewhere else to get his dinner. These little piggies are home free." "All contingent on us being able to save something," Vic said, "which is about as likely as the Cleveland Indians winning the World Series this fall." "I think we better try, buddy." Vic sat silent, looking at his congealing sandwich and thinking. It was totally unfair, but he could live with unfairness. What really hurt was the whole situation's crazed absurdity. It had blown up out of a clear sky like a killer tornado that lays a zigzagging trail of destruction and then disappears. He and Roger and AdWorks itself were apt to be numbered among the fatalities, no matter what they did. He could read it on Roger's round face, which had not looked so pallidly serious since he and Althea had lost their boy Timothy to the crib death syndrome when the infant was only 9 days old. 3 weeks after that happened, Roger had broken down and wept, his hands plastered to his fat face in a kind of terrible, hopeless sorrow that had squeezed Vic's heart into his throat. That had been bad. But the incipient panic he saw in Roger's eyes now was bad, too. Tornadoes blew out of nowhere in the advertising business from time to time. A big outfit like the Ellison Agency, which billed in the millions, could withstand them. A little one, like AdWorks, just couldn't. They had been carrying one basket with a lot of little eggs in it, and another basket with one big egg, the Sharp account. And it now remained to be seen whether the big egg had been lost entirely, or if it could at least be scrambled. None of it had been their fault, but ad agencies make lovely whipping boys. Vic and Roger had teamed naturally together ever since their first joint effort at the Ellison Agency 6 years ago. Vic, tall and skinny and rather quiet, had formed the perfect yin for Roger Breakstone's fat, happy, and extroverted yang. They had clicked on a personal basis and on a professional one. That first assignment had been a minor one, to submit a magazine ad campaign for United Cerebral Palsy. They had come up with a stark black-and-white ad that showed a small boy in huge, cruel leg braces standing in foul territory by the first base line of a little league ball field. A New York Mets cap was perched on his head, And his expression, Roger had always maintained that it had been the boy's expression which sold the ad, wasn't sad at all. It was simply dreamy, almost happy, in fact. The copy read simply, Billy Bellamy is never going to bat cleanup. Beneath, Billy has cerebral palsy. Beneath that, smaller type, give us a hand, huh? CP donations had taken a noticeable leap. Good for them. Good for Vic and Roger. The team of Trenton and Breakstone had been off and running. Half a dozen successful campaigns had followed, Vic dealing most commonly with broad-scope conception, Roger dealing with actual execution. For the Sony Corporation, a picture of a man sitting cross-legged on the median strip of a 16-lane superhighway in a business suit, a big Sony radio on his lap, a seraphic smile on his kisser. The copy read, Police Band, the Rolling Stones, Vivaldi, Mike Wallace, the Kingston Trio, Paul Harvey, Patti Smith, Jerry Falwell. And below that, Hello, L.A. For the Voight people, makers of swim equipment, an ad that showed a man who was the utter antithesis of the Miami Beach Boy, standing arrogantly hip-shot on the golden beach of some tropical paradise. The model was a 50-year-old man with tattoos, a beer belly, flab-muscled arms and legs, and a puckered scar high across one thigh. In his arms, this battered soldier of fortune was cradling a pair of Voight swim fins. Mister, the copy for this one read, I dive for a living. I don't mess around. There was a lot more underneath, stuff Roger always referred to as the blah-blah, but the copy set in boldface was the real hooker. Vic and Roger had wanted it to read, I don't screw around, but they hadn't been able to sell the Voight people on that. Pity, Vic was fond of saying over drinks. They could have sold a lot more swim fins. Then there was Sharp. The Sharp Company of Cleveland had stood 12th in the Great American Bake Stakes when old man Sharp reluctantly came to the Ellison Agency in New York after more than 20 years with the hometown ad agency. Sharp had been bigger than Nabisco before World War II, the old man was fond of pointing out. His son was just as fond of pointing out that World War II had ended 30 years ago. The account, on a six-month trial basis at first, had been handed over to Vic Trenton and Roger Breakstone. At the end of the trial period, Sharp had vaulted from 12th in the cookies, cakes, and cereals market to 9th. A year later, when Vic and Roger pulled up stakes and moved to Maine to open up their own business, the Sharp Company had climbed to 7th. Their campaign had been a sweeping one. For Sharp Cookies, Vic and Roger had developed the Cookie Sharpshooter, a bumbling Western peace officer whose six guns shot cookies instead of bullets, courtesy of the special effects people, chocolate chippers in some spots, ginger snappies in others, oh, those oatmeals in still others. The spots always ended with the sharpshooter standing sadly in a pile of cookies with his guns out. Well, the bad guys got away, he'd tell millions of Americans every day or so. But I got the cookies. Best cookies in the West, or anywhere else, I reckon. The sharpshooter bites into a cookie. His expression suggests that he is experiencing the gastronomic equivalent of a boy's first orgasm. Fade out. For the prepared cakes, 16 different varieties ranging from pound to crumb to cheese, there was what Vic called the George and Gracie spot. We fade in on George and Gracie leaving a posh dinner party where the buffet table groans with every possible delicacy. We dissolve to a dingy little cold water flat, starkly lighted. George is sitting at a plain kitchen table with a checked tablecloth. Gracie takes a sharp pound cake, or cheesecake, or crumb cake, from the freezer of their old refrigerator and sets it on the table. They are both still in their evening clothes. They smile into each other's eyes with warmth and love and understanding. Two people who are utterly in sync with each other. Fade to these words on black. Sometimes all you want is a sharp cake. Not a word spoken in the entire spot. That one had won a Clio. As had the sharp cereal professor, hailed in the trades as the most responsible advertisement ever produced for children's programming. Vic and Roger had considered it their crowning achievement. But now it was the sharp cereal professor who had come back to haunt them. Played by a character actor in late middle age, the sharp serial professor